No, the report said nothing of the kind. The Microsoft Word thesaurus, which is even easier for me to consult while writing than the one built into Google, lists the following words as synonyms for singularly: unusually, especially, exceptionally, rarely, and surprisingly. So Cruz was saying that the DOJ had called the assault weapons ban exceptionally ineffective. Of course, not only does the report say no such thing, but it repeatedly makes the exact opposite point, which was that there was not yet enough evidence to draw any conclusive determination. Ted was being singularly dishonest and exceptionally smarmy. After our hearings on the assault weapons ban, we went into executive session to mark up the bill. When it came time for Ted to speak, he treated us all to a breathtakingly patronizing lecture directed at Senator Feinstein, who had been in the Senate for 20 years, compared to Ted's 2 months. After helpfully reminding Diane that the Constitution is our foundational document and that the First and Second Amendments of the Constitution are part of the Bill of Rights, Ted went in for the kill. And the question that I would pose to the senior senator from California is, would she deem it consistent with the Bill of Rights for Congress to engage in the same endeavor that we are contemplating doing with the Second Amendment in the context of the First or Fourth Amendment? Namely, would she consider it constitutional for Congress to specify that the First Amendment shall apply only to the following books and shall not apply to the books that Congress has deemed outside the protection of the Bill of Rights? You get what he was trying to say, right? The bill would have outlawed assault weapons while leaving other guns legal. And Ted was suggesting that this was equivalent to selectively banning books. If this sounds like a very private school debate club way to talk about gun safety, please rest assured that it was delivered in the most private school debate club tone possible, like an actor performing a monologue in which he plays an intolerably smug, self-righteous high school debater in a blue blazer with brass buttons, but way, way overdoing it. Ted's condescension hung in the air like the stench from a cat box in an apartment with 40 cats belonging to an elderly woman who had just been found dead. It was bad, is what I'm saying. Dick Durbin jumped in. Would the senator yield for a question? But Diane wanted to respond herself. Let me just make a couple of points in response. One, I am not a sixth grader. Barely containing her anger, she reminded Ted that not only had she been a member of the Judiciary Committee for 20 years, but before that, she had been the mayor of San Francisco, an office to which she ascended when her predecessor, George Moscone, was assassinated, along with Supervisor Harvey Milk. In fact, Diane had been the one who discovered Harvey Milk's body. "I've seen the bullets that implode," she growled at Ted. Diane finished by reassuring Ted that she was familiar with the Constitution and sarcastically thanking him for the lecture. There was a sort of stunned silence. Then Chairman Leahy noted that Dick Durbin had asked for the floor. "Mr. Chairman," said Dick, "I can't add anything to that." But Ted could. Instead of dissolving into a fine pink shame mist, he piped up to clap back at the distinguished public servant who had just taken him to the woodshed. "I would note," he oozed, "that the senior senator from California did not answer my question, which is, in her judgment, would it be consistent with the Constitution for Congress to specify which books are permitted and which books are not?" "Well," I chimed in, "I've got a book that I don't think the First Amendment would permit. It's called Ted Cruz is a Pedophile." "That would be libel, unless, of course, you are a pedophile, which we don't know." No, I didn't say that, but man, I wanted to, and I kind of wish I had. Around that time, Amy Klobuchar was preparing to speak at the Gridiron Club Dinner, an annual black tie affair held by the oldest and most prestigious organization for journalists in Washington. Traditionally, the president gives humorous remarks, as do two members of Congress, one from each party. For the record, Amy doesn't let me write jokes for her. That way, if someone asks her if I wrote any of her jokes, she can honestly say no. Besides, Amy's really funny and can fend for herself. But sometimes she'll run jokes by me, and every once in a while I'll have a suggestion on how to punch up one or two. Now, this was in early March of 2013, just a couple weeks after a Carnival cruise ship had been towed in the harbor after almost a week stranded at sea because of an engine fire. The ship had been nicknamed the Poop Cruise because passengers said the hallways were flooded with human waste, which had inspired a joke that Amy ran by me. When most people think of a bad cruise, they think of Carnival, but we think of Ted. I thought that was pretty good, but suggested a rewrite, which I'll get to in a moment. The Thursday before the Gridiron, as we were taking a series of votes on the floor, I noticed Amy going around to a few senators she had written jokes about. Ah, I thought, Amy's getting their blessing. Then I saw her walk up to Ted. I thought, this could be interesting. So I went right over and inserted myself into a conversation triangle. Ted, Amy smiled, I've written a joke about you for the Gridiron, and I wanted to get your okay. Sure, Ted smiled back. What's the joke? Well, Amy smiled, here it is. When most people think of a difficult cruise, they think of Carnival. But we Democrats in the Senate think of Ted. I noticed, of course, that she had softened the joke a bit, changing a bad cruise to a difficult cruise, and changing we think of Ted to we Democrats in the Senate think of Ted. Ted smiled. Then he offered a suggestion. What if you changed a difficult cruise to a challenging cruise? Oh my God, what a putz. Now the joke isn't funny. I could tell that Amy was thinking the same thing, and so could Ted. So before Amy could respond, he smiled even more broadly and said magnanimously, I'll tell you what, I believe in the First Amendment. You go ahead and tell your joke. Wow, that was patronizing. I decided to step in. Say, Ted, I smiled. I did a rewrite of Amy's joke, and I think it's a lot better. You want to hear it? Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Amy having two successive thoughts. One, oh no, Al's not going to do this. Two, but I definitely want to be here if he does. Ted was still smiling. Sure. Okay, here it is. When most people think of a cruise that's full of shit, they think of Carnival. But we think of Ted. And there went Ted's smile. For once, he had no words. I nodded, turned around, and walked away. Keep in mind, this all happened within 2 months of Ted's arrival in Washington. There are senators who take 6 months slowly getting to know people and getting to know the institution before they even make their first floor speech, let alone manage to convince every other senator to hate them. Ted wasted no time pissing everybody off, including his fellow Republicans. A couple weeks before the gun debate, the Armed Services Committee held a hearing on Chuck Hagel's nomination to be defense secretary. Now, it wasn't unusual for a Republican senator to give an Obama appointee a hard time, but Chuck Hagel was a former Republican senator from Nebraska. The Republican side of the dais was packed with senators who had known and worked with and respected Hagel for decades. But Ted decided to deliver another Cruzian performance piece, questioning the source of payments that Hagel had received for speaking engagements after leaving the Senate and making an inflammatory insinuation. It is, at a minimum, relevant to know if that $200,000 that he deposited in his bank account came directly from Saudi Arabia, came directly from North Korea. Yeah, just like it would be relevant to know if you were a pedophile, Ted. But at least I had the good taste not to say that out loud, but instead to write it in a book 5 years later. Republicans were at least polite about brushing back the brash new senator, with Lindsey Graham saying Cruz's remarks were out of bounds. Democrats in the media were less restrained, comparing Ted's intimation to McCarthy-esque innuendo. It takes a special kind of jerk to get compared to Joe McCarthy just a month into your Senate career. Although it didn't help Ted that he bears more than a passing resemblance to McCarthy himself. Franny thinks he's the love child of McCarthy and Dracula. Of course, Ted has been leaving a bad taste in people's mouths his whole life. His college roommate, screenwriter Craig Mazin, had been warning people about Cruz since the moment he leapt onto the national stage in the 2012 election, and when Ted ran for president in 2016, Mazin was only too happy to share some memories of what young Ted Cruz had been like. As a freshman, he tweeted one day, I would get into senior parties because I was Ted's roommate, out of pity. He was that widely loathed. It's his superpower. Keep in mind, this is at Princeton. Ted Cruz was too much of a smug jerk to fit in at Princeton. And then he went to Harvard Law School, where, during his very first week, he created a study group. Hey, that's kind of human. Except that, in order to apply to be part of Ted's study group, you had to have gone to Harvard, Princeton, or Yale for college. GQ interviewed Ted's law school roommate, who explained, he said he didn't want anybody from minor Ivies, like Penn or Brown. Now, if I spent 1,000 years on a desert island, I couldn't come up with a more obnoxious way to show my new classmates that I was a world-class butthole. I could fill several chapters with Ted Cruz's awfulness. But I'll end with one of my favorite keepsakes from my time in the Senate. It was a picture taken during an especially long and tedious executive session of the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, during which we discussed and voted on Tom Udall's proposed constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision. The amendment would have simply restored the power of Congress and the states to regulate and set reasonable limits on the raising and spending of money by candidates and others to influence elections. Such laws, of course, had existed for many years before the Supreme Court decided to wipe them all out with a 5-4 vote. Ted opposed this, of course, and spoke against it in pieces that added up to a good hour, making bogus point after bogus point, which was why the hearing was so long and tedious. This amendment here today, he said at one point, would repeal the free speech protections of the First Amendment. And this amendment, if adopted, would give Congress absolute authority to regulate the political speech of every single American with no limitations whatsoever. And later, any politician who put his or her name to an amendment taking away the free speech rights of every American, in my view, should be embarrassed. Stuff like that. He also tied together his blatant disregard for the truth, his relentless appetite for grandstanding, and his cringeworthy habit of making pop culture references in an argument that seemed designed just to irritate me, referring to the political satire on Saturday Night Live, specifically Tina Fey playing Sarah Palin. According to Ted, if Citizens United were to be reversed, Tina would not have been able to do her Sarah Palin on the show because NBC is a corporation. Of course, as I pointed out, Tina did Sarah Palin during the 2008 election, 2 years before the Citizens United decision. Danny Aykroyd did Carter before Citizens United. Phil Hartman did Reagan. Dana Carvey did George H.W. Bush. Hartman did Bill Clinton, as did Daryl Hammond. And Will Ferrell did George W. Bush, all before Citizens United. So even if you bought Ted's bogus argument that preventing corporations from pouring billions of dollars in dark money into shadowy super PACs was equivalent to outlawing any political speech on the public airwaves, this wasn't even a relevant example. It was just a dishonest and unpleasant man trying and failing to use pop culture to make a false argument. In fact, a few months later, he made the same argument in a floor speech where he added, Lorne Michaels could be put in jail under this amendment for making fun of any politician. Ted Cruz isn't just wrong about almost everything. He's impossible to work with. And he doesn't care that he's impossible to work with. And that's why even when the choice was between Ted Cruz, who was a sitting member of the United States Senate, and Donald Trump, who was Donald Trump, establishment Republicans couldn't bring themselves to rally behind Cruz. Even if you like what he stands for, the most he'll ever be able to accomplish is being an obnoxious wrench in the gears of government, like when he led the government shutdown over the Affordable Care Act. Real senatoring requires that you build productive relationships with your colleagues, and Ted just isn't that kind of guy. Which brings me to that photograph from the hearing. Now, you're not going to see it, but in the picture, you see Dick Durbin just painfully staring out to middle distance, just in anguish out of boredom. Me, painfully bored. Josh staring in boredom. And Cruz talking. And has the inscription, sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words of sophistry. Chapter 38, Bulletproof. After the massacre at Sandy Hook, a number of my Republican colleagues responded by saying something on the order of, this isn't just about guns. It's about the culture and mental health. As someone who'd been working on mental health issues since I got to the Senate, I knew that a number of these colleagues had never expressed any interest in the subject. It was like they were checking off a box by saying the words mental and health, and saying them in the right order. Even worse, by raising mental health only in the context of gun violence, they were stigmatizing mental illness. The shooters in Newtown and Aurora and Tucson and Orlando were demented. And of course, early intervention can help avert some acts of violence, but the fact is that people with mental illness are on the whole no more likely to be violent and are actually more likely to be victims of violence than the general population. Virtually every family in America is touched by a behavioral health problem, mental illness or addiction. Addressing these issues in a smart, comprehensive, and compassionate way will relieve suffering, save families and lives, give us a more productive workforce, save tons of money in law enforcement and our prisons and in emergency room visits. And yes, maybe prevent someone from becoming so psychotic that they shoot up a movie theater or a nightclub or an elementary school. My friend Paul Wellstone was profoundly affected by watching his brother struggle with depression. And one of his Republican colleagues, New Mexico's Pete Domenici, was profoundly affected by his daughter's schizophrenia. So in the Senate, they teamed up to try to help Americans get the care they need. Back then, one barrier to getting that care was the exceptionally high cost of treatment. Many health insurance plans would cover surgery for a broken arm, but not medication for crippling anxiety or treatment for a drug addiction. Mental health issues were seen, at least within the health insurance market, as somehow less important or less real or, in any case, less worthy of coverage. Wellstone and Domenici tried to change that by fighting for what was known as mental health parity, which would simply require insurance plans that cover mental health services to cover them to the same extent as medical and surgical services. This extremely simple, extremely common sense, extremely humane reform didn't become law until October 2008. Yep, Paul Wellstone's most meaningful legislative achievement came 6 years after his death. The fight to pass the Wellstone-Domenici Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act was led in the House by Democrat Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island and Republican Jim Ramstead of Minnesota. Both are recovering alcoholics, but Patrick had the harder road to recovery. John F. Kennedy wrote a book called Profiles in Courage. But to me, the family's greatest profile in courage may well be Patrick. He never let his own very public and very embarrassing struggles with addiction and mental illness keep him from fighting to help others with mental health and addiction disorders get the care they needed. My own interest in mental health issues came partly from how much I respected Paul's work on the issue, and partly because, as you may recall, I too had been affected by loved ones who suffered from a behavioral disease, alcohol and chemical addiction. When I got to the Senate, I was eager to do my part to carry on Paul's legacy and, if possible, expand upon it. First step, pushing the Department of Health and Human Services to finalize the regulations prescribed by the Wellstone-Domenici Act. It was complex, painstaking work, and I was responsible for almost none of it. It was undertaken mostly by my health care legislative staff, working with the Department of Health and Human Services. And it remains a work in progress. Wellstone-Domenici is now fully implemented, and the Affordable Care Act built on its success by requiring that all policies sold through the exchange cover behavioral health services, including addiction treatment, which has been a lifesaver for many during the ongoing opioid crisis. But we are still nowhere near where we need to be in making sure that people who need treatment for mental illness and addiction can always get it. Then came the rash of mass shootings and the rash of national conversations about mental health. Lots of people were declaring that we needed to do something, but nobody was really clear on what exactly we could or should do. In frustration, I asked the president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness how to respond. She gave me a one-word answer: schools. She arranged a roundtable at a school in the Mounds View School District. The school had adopted an approach to mental health that seemed to be working. All the adults in the school community, from the principal and the teachers to the bus driver and the lunch ladies, had been taught what it looks like when a kid is dealing with mental health problems. If they saw a kid who seemed to be struggling, they could ask a mental health professional, a counselor, a psychologist, a social worker, or a therapist, to check in with the student and determine whether he or she had a serious mental health issue. That professional would connect the child with mental health services in the Mounds View community. At the round table, three mothers raved about what a difference this program had made for their children and their families. One in particular, Katie Johnson, made a profound impact on me. Katie told me that she was a single mother of two, a 9-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. "My son," she said, "was completely out of control. So my life was completely out of control. I was in total despair." One day, Katie got a call from a woman who introduced herself as the mental health advocate for Katie's son. "She's become my best friend," Katie told me. Katie's son was diagnosed with ADHD and Asperger's. They treated him, and he completely turned around. Now he's doing well in school, and he's taking Taekwondo. Katie looked me straight in the eye with the confidence of someone who had gone through a horrific ordeal and found herself safely on the other side. After years of chaos and frustration, her son was finally on the right track, and her own life finally felt manageable. Pointing to her heart, she told me proudly, "I am now bulletproof." I thought, let's do this. There was a gun bill working its way through the Senate, so I added an amendment that would fund training for people who work in schools to identify warning signs of mental illness and help detect and treat issues as early as possible. My colleagues understood the wisdom of the idea right away, and my provision passed by a nearly unanimous vote. But as you may recall, the gun bill failed. Still, the idea stuck. Soon after, we got $100 million in new funding to improve mental health services in schools, and we've gotten more since. This money has helped train a lot of adults in schools to intervene when a student is having trouble, and it's helped schools to hire a lot more counselors and social workers to treat those students, and it's helped a lot of kids. But not every kid. On an issue like mental health, there's never a big, dramatic final victory. There's never a signing ceremony where the president officially abolishes undiagnosed mental illness once and for all. Kids and adults struggle with mental illness every day, and too many of them never get the help they need. And that's just kind of how it works. Sometimes you work your whole life to do something simple and noble, and it doesn't happen until 6 years after your death. Sometimes it never happens at all. Sometimes you get 94 of your colleagues to vote for your amendment, but the bill itself fails on a cynical partisan filibuster. Sometimes you see a breaking news banner on the TV in your office, and something awful has happened. And you get the creeping sensation that the whole sad national conversation is about to begin again. But sometimes you can make a little progress, and sometimes you get to see what that progress looks like. A few days after we secured that first batch of funding, I went to Westwood Elementary School in Bloomington, Minnesota for another roundtable. There was real excitement among the 20-some people who had heard about the new funding for programs like the one that was working in their school. Westwood has a therapist in residence, so parents don't have to take the better part of a day to pick their kid up to ferry them to and from an appointment. A 10-year-old boy told me how much his therapist, a cheerful young woman in her early 30s, had helped him. When he sees her in the hall during recess, he said, he gives her a big high five. Talk about destigmatizing. When you're a senator and you go to these roundtables, it's often just one person after another telling you incredibly sad or depressing or inspiring stories. Me being me, I have a ritual to sort of puncture the emotions so I can switch gears and get my head into the next event. And after this roundtable, my driver, Brett, and I walked out to the car, climbed in, buckled up, and per our ritual, I nodded at Brett and said, "Fooled him again." But this time I added, almost to myself, "I'm a good senator." Chapter 39. Cracks in My Soul. The Democratic Senator's Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot legislate, the courage to legislate the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference, and the patience to explain that difference to my donors. Probably the most enjoyable part of public service is the fundraising. That's because you get to spend endless hours on the phone talking with people from all walks of life, though mainly rich people, and also you mostly talk to their voicemail or assistants. Not only that, but when you do manage to get them on the phone, the people on the other end are super excited to talk to you because they know exactly why you're calling, to ask them for their support. And if you're not sitting in a small room with your call time manager, calling people for 3 or 4 hours at a stretch, you may very well be flying across the country to speak to your supporters at the sumptuous home of a wealthy donor who wisely chose not to go into public service. Or even better, you might be flying across the country in the middle of the night. Flying in the middle of the night gives you plenty of time to examine the choices you've made in your life, or to sleep, but also to write thank you notes to donors. Okay, let's back up. Unfortunately, unless you're very rich or not interested in winning, you need to raise money if you're going to run for office. You need the resources to put a team together, to rent office space, to buy phones and computers and printers and toner, to feed volunteers, to travel around your state, to make ads, and to put the ads on the air. So before I go any further, let me just thank everyone who has ever contributed to my campaigns. The vast majority of you are not wealthy and give 5, 10, or 25 of your hard-earned dollars. In fact, more than 90% of the donations I've received are $50 or less. Without the generosity of people who don't own sumptuous homes, I would not be in the position I am to fight for the things we believe in. Despite my success with direct mail and online fundraising from small donors, I have to raise a lot of money the old-fashioned way, by picking up the phone and calling rich people. And it takes a little trial and error to discover what works and what gets you a restraining order. My first fundraising call in late 2005 was to a successful St. Paul lawyer, John Farrisee. Though we had never met, John took my call because he was familiar with my work as a comedian, author, and radio host. I made my pitch for the pack I had started, and John immediately agreed to give. How much was I looking for? I peered down at the notes on my call sheet. Well, I guess $5,000. John said, okay. I paused and then asked, are you sure? I remember this only because John told the story to gales of laughter at one of my fundraising dinners in 2014. Call time is just you and your call time manager, a young staffer who's printing out and handing you call sheets and reminding you about any special information you might need to remember. Maybe the person you're calling missed your last event because they were at their mother's funeral or at a child's hockey game. Or maybe they particularly love your work on fighting climate change. Sometimes you dial the phone, other times your call time manager does. Sometimes you have to do all the talking, sometimes the person you're calling talks. Sometimes they talk too much. As you dial, you peruse the person's giving history, every donation they've ever made over the past several election cycles, not just to you, but to everyone. That's all public information, by the way. Also on my call sheets are notes from A.J. Goodman, the former death row attorney who has been my national fundraising director for the last 11 years. A.J. makes the best call sheets, which include reminders like, don't call the home, the wife hates politics, or call her cell, he's a Republican, or they're divorced, no more Sharon, no more Sharon money. Am I giving you a good sense of what call time is like? Did you tune out when I mentioned giving history and then perk up a little bit when you heard death row? I don't know how interesting this sounds, but call time is less interesting than that. It's not uncommon to have 3 straight hours of call time scheduled as part of your day. During my recount, I often did 8 hours of call time in a day. It's brutal. But I probably hate call time less than most elected officials do. See, when I was in comedy, I used to edit, which involves sitting in an edit room for hours on end while a skilled craftsman makes the edits that you and your co-writer or the director request. It means reviewing all the takes for pieces of the best performances and looking for different camera angles and sizes, close-up, two-shot, wide, to cut around weaker performance moments. This can be more or less interesting than it sounds, depending on what you're editing and whether you're the one calling the shots. But whatever the case, I would always make a conscious decision to enjoy myself. You're going to be in this room for 5 hours, I would tell myself. You might as well enjoy it. That's my call time philosophy, too. Just as I try to make fundraising emails fun for the people who read them, I try to make call time fun for myself and my call time manager and for whomever I'm calling. Let's say I get the assistant of an attorney in Dallas. I'll say, hi, this is Al Franken calling for Mr. Hudnut. I'm sorry, but Mr. Hudnut is in a meeting. All right, well, I'm calling to invite him and Sandra to a fundraiser for me in Dallas on October 11th. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Hudnut will be out of the country on October 11th. Uh-huh, I say. And will the Hudnut's checkbook be out of the country? That almost always gets a laugh, and often money. Over the course of the many hours I have spent in call time during the last decade, I have composed, as a sanity maintenance device, a musical entitled Call Time, the Musical. The musical takes place in a call room with me and my call time manager, a table, and a phone. The audience can hear the phone on the other end. While it's ringing, I sing to the tune of Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. Please answer the phone, Howard Goldfein. You maxed to me last cycle. Oh, won't you be home, Howard Goldfein. Now, I would have sung that here, but we have a legal issue. Anyway, if there's no answer, the audience hears the Goldfein's outgoing message, an adorable little girl saying, The Goldfines aren't home now. And then I leave a charming message. Elise, this is Al Franken. You have a very young-sounding voice. I guess Howard robbed the cradle. Listen, I'm going to be in Cleveland Thursday, April 7th, for a fundraiser at the home of Danny and Marilyn Lasky in Shaker Heights. And I'd love for you both to come. You can call A.J. Goodman at 555-287-6543 for all the details. A.J.'s a she, a female person. She's a woman. Then I hang up and sing Call Time's signature tune. I left a message. It's a signature tune for two reasons. First, because it's so catchy and upbeat. And second, because I sing it roughly 75 times over the course of the show, which lasts 6 hours with no intermission unless I have to go to the bathroom. Also, it provides almost all of Call Time's production values. Because while I sing I left a message, the chorus members, who include 6 ballerinas, 4 jugglers, some acrobats, and several chimpanzees riding tricycles, enter, do their stuff, and sing their parts. Starts with me. I left a message on the phone. Woo! I left a message. They were not home. No, no, no. That was the chorus going, no, no, no. I left a message. Oh, yes, I did. Ow, ow. I left a message. I do not kid. He left a message. Oh, yes, he did. Wah, wah. He left a message. He does not kid. Yay! Then the orchestra plays them off to thunderous applause. Seriously, without Call Time the musical, my Call Time manager and I would go crazy. You might be wondering who this Call Time manager is and how he or she can stand to do this job. After all, he or she has to sit through all these calls too, but never gets to talk to anyone but me. On the other hand, I am raising the funds that will be used to pay his or her salary, so there's that. But because there is a burnout rate, I've actually had several Call Time managers over the years. Each has contributed in their own way to Call Time the musical. The Beltway sensation Brian Heenan made a key breakthrough when he started to lavish praise upon my performance with every call. That was a great message, Brian would say with absolute sincerity after I left a voicemail. If I were her, I'd go to the fundraiser. Or when I'd hang up after a long call with a prospective donor, Brian would say, on this end, from what I heard, that was a great conversation. I bet she maxes out. Now, Andy Osborne, who replaced Brian when the original cast departed, developed a running bit based on my suggestion that Rain Man would be the ideal Call Time manager. Definitely call the house, 555-681-2372. Last time you called, January 27, 2009, you called the office. Definitely called the office, 555-724-0966. The assistant, Brenda Downey, said definitely call the house. Or, definitely max out to you in 2008. Gary gave $2,400 on April 12, 2007 for the primary. Attended Larry David event. Definitely attended. Another $2,400 for general. Definitely June 21st, 2008, summer solstice. Mary Alla also gave the full $4,800, also at the Larry David event. She's a big Larry David fan. Definitely loves Curb Your Enthusiasm. Definitely. Would definitely sleep with Larry David. She said that? Yes, but I added definitely. She just said, I'd sleep with Larry David. Rain Man, she was joking. No reaction from Rain Man. Now, you'll notice I referred to Larry David. This is more than just a casual name drop like my earlier mentions of Call Time manager Brian Heenan and Dallas super lawyer Mr. Hudnut. One of the things Norm Coleman attacked me for during that first campaign was that I received a lot of campaign money from the left coast Hollywood elite, who are poisoning our culture and contributing to the breakdown of the American family. And indeed, over the years, I've gotten a lot of support from people in show business, especially people I worked with over my 35 years in the industry. So as Republican lines of attack went, this was among the least dishonest, but that didn't make it any less silly. For one thing, like many Republicans, Coleman was raising much of his money from big oil and big pharma and big insurance. So I was happy to admit that I was raising money from what I called big comedy. It's hard to argue that Ben Stiller has been a worse influence on our country than ExxonMobil, even if you were very disappointed with Zoolander 2. But the real difference was that I had actually worked in big comedy. These were people I had made movies and TV shows with. These were people who know me personally. These were my friends. Norm Coleman, on the other hand, had never been a wildcatter in the oil fields. He had never developed a life-saving drug in the research lab of a pharmaceutical company. He hadn't spent his career before politics as an actuary in the insurance business. I got money from big comedy because my friends wanted to support me. My opponent got money from big oil and big pharma and big insurance because they wanted something from him. This is why I and many other people have long called for public financing of elections. It's not just that all this fundraising is a huge pain and a distraction from the work our elected officials should be spending their time doing, reading briefing books, or just books, talking to experts, crafting legislation, and meeting with constituents. The role of big money in our politics gives special interests a bigger megaphone than people who can't write big checks. Of course, the influence of special interests is now greater than ever, thanks to the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in Citizens United, and the Republicans' refusal to let us do anything to bring some transparency and accountability back to our elections. In the court's majority opinion, Justice Kennedy tried to reassure people that allowing corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals to spend unlimited money in elections is really nothing to worry about. With the advent of the Internet, Kennedy wrote, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. Well, in theory. Except that under Citizens United, there was no requirement that these expenditures actually be disclosed, which made it kind of hard for anyone to be held accountable. Now, we Democrats tried to pass a law that would actually mandate prompt disclosure of expenditures by the new groups that sprung up like weeds after Citizens United so that shareholders and citizens could use that information to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. We called it the Democracy is Strengthened by Casting Light on Spending in Elections Act, which by happy coincidence we later discovered could be shortened to the Disclose Act. Like any bill, the Disclose Act would need 60 votes to pass the Senate, and at the time, we had only 59, which shouldn't have been a problem. Given their past statements about the importance of disclosure, you'd have thought that Republicans would have been lining up to co-sponsor the Disclose Act. In a floor speech, I quoted my colleagues who had voted against the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law that passed in 2002 on the grounds that we didn't need limits on campaign donations if we only had disclosure. For example, there was Chuck Grassley. We can try to regulate ethical behavior by politicians, but the surest way to cleanse the system is to let the sunshine in. There was Lamar Alexander, who I can't imitate. I support campaign finance reform, but to me that means individual contributions, free speech, and full disclosure. There was Orrin Hatch. The issue is expenditures, 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 and the issue, the real issue, if we really want to do something about campaign finance reform, is disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. Even Mitch McConnell had said, public disclosure of campaign contributions and spending should be expedited so voters can judge for themselves what is appropriate. But as much as my Republican colleagues had sung the praises of disclosure and hailed Justice Kennedy's decision in Citizens United as wise jurisprudence, Senate Republicans secretly knew they had been handed a huge advantage thanks to the most outrageous act of judicial activism in a generation, and they weren't about to look this gift horse in the mouth. The day of the disclose vote, it was clear that the Republican filibuster would hold. I was a bit peeved at the hypocrisy, and after casting my own futile vote to move the bill forward, I stood in the well during the rest of the vote to give my good friends a bit of friendly crap. This led to the single dumbest thing a colleague has ever said to me, which is quite a high bar. After watching one of the Republicans who had spoken about the importance of disclosure 8 years earlier vote no on the Disclose Act, I asked him rather churlishly, "What happened to sunshine is the best disinfectant?" "I'm protecting the Constitution," he replied, equally churlishly, then moved on. Another Republican, however, felt the need to defend him, also churlishly. "Well, there are parts of the bill we're not comfortable with," he said. "Okay," I replied, "name one thing in the bill you have a problem with." My colleague blanked and, without responding, turned to the clerk, voting no. Another Republican colleague, having overheard the last two exchanges, said to me, civilly, I admit, though I thought I could still detect a hint of churlishness, "Well, the bill treats different entities differently." This was a line of argument Republicans used often, usually claiming that Democrats wanted to place new obstacles on the political power of corporations while further empowering labor unions. "No, it doesn't," I said, having plenty of practice knocking down this bogus claim. "It treats unions the same as corporations and the same as individuals." Now, here comes the single dumbest thing a colleague has ever said to me. "Well, let's say the New York Times prints an editorial. It doesn't have to disclose." My jaw dropped. I gave my colleague a second to figure out why that had been a spectacularly stupid argument, but it didn't seem like he was getting it. "It's in the New York Times," I explained, as unchurlishly as I could manage. "Oh," he realized, "right." Then he turned to the clerk and voted no. The proliferation of money in politics is a huge problem, and as I'll explain in the next chapter, it has some pretty terrible consequences. But does this mean that elected officials are all bought and paid for? The truth I've discovered is a little more complicated. Campaign contributions don't buy votes. What they buy is access. That's why lobbyists write campaign checks. They're not bribes, they're grease. They enable those lobbyists to come to fundraisers where they get to talk to you while you're trying to remember their names. Gross, right? And it is. I hear from a lot of lobbyists, and yes, some of them are every bit as transactional as you're imagining. But others, often the more effective ones, are actually passionate about the issue they're representing. And while lobbying, and all the money associated with it, offers lots of opportunities for corruption, lobbying itself isn't inherently corrupt. Many lobbyists represent good causes like solar energy or Alzheimer's research or a woman's reproductive rights. They may have donated to you not in order to buy your support going forward, but because you've been supporting their good cause all along. And more often than not, you're not meeting with them because of a check they wrote, but rather because you're on the same team. You're strategizing together about how to move the ball forward and trading useful information about how to achieve a shared goal. That doesn't mean I'm pro-lobbyists. In fact, during my first campaign, I called for a lifetime lobbying ban on former members of Congress. It didn't seem right to me that after holding the high honor of public service, you could just cash out and make millions off your access to former colleagues. And it still doesn't. I still want to ban former members of Congress from becoming lobbyists. And for that matter, I still want public financing for elections so current and prospective members of Congress don't have to spend so much time fundraising. But the issue looks different from the inside than it did from the outside. In 2005, Norm Coleman voted for an energy bill that gave subsidies to the oil and gas industry. It was easy to draw a direct line between those votes and the money he got from big oil, and during the campaign, I drew that line with great enthusiasm. Norton's response was always that the same bill created the Renewable Fuel Standard, or RFS, which includes the ethanol mandate. Now, the oil and gas industry doesn't have a big presence in Minnesota, but we grow a lot of corn and soybeans, and corn ethanol and other biofuels like biodiesel produced from soybean oil have been extremely important to the economy of rural Minnesota. In other words, the RFS is good for my state. The oil and gas subsidies in the bill were bad for everyone except the oil and gas industry and oil and gas states. But while I'm sure Norm was less bothered by those subsidies than I would have been, the truth is that, on balance, I might well have wound up casting the same vote he did. Was it unfair for me to say that Norm was in the pocket of big oil? Nah. But was it entirely accurate to say that he only voted for this bill because he had been bought off? Probably not. In 2010, I took a trip to Israel and met with some members of the Knesset. I had never given it any thought before, but every member of the Knesset represents all of Israel. There is no member representing the northern suburbs of Tel Aviv. Our system is different. House members in Congress represent their districts. Senators represent our states. I was elected to represent the people of Minnesota. When I'm trying to decide how to vote on a bill, whether or not something is good for my state is always at the top of my mind. But of course, it's not even close to the only consideration. Does the stuff in this bill I like outweigh the stuff I don't like? If I vote for it, can I get the senator who sponsored it to vote for something of mine? If I vote against it, can we get a better deal later? What does my staff think? What do the experts I trust say? Has Atul Gawande weighed in at all? Every so often, we have to pass what's known as a continuing resolution, which extends current levels of funding so we can keep the government open and functioning until we can agree on an actual budget. Often, this is a big end-of-the-year package and may contain any number of things that are just awful, and also any number of things that are great, including one or two pieces of legislation that I myself have authored and have been fighting to pass for several years. Also, if the thing doesn't pass, the government shuts down. Obviously, there's a point at which a continuing resolution could be so bad that I'd have to vote against it, even if it meant voting against stuff I liked or even authored, or even shutting the government down. But where is that point? I mean, it would have to be a really bad continuing resolution in order for me to vote against it, unless I knew it was going to pass even without my vote, in which case maybe I could vote against it as a protest of the stuff I didn't like. Then again, on principle, shouldn't you always vote as if you were the deciding vote? I used to think that, but I gave up a while ago, and I can't even remember what the hell that was about. The point is, there are all sorts of reasons why someone might vote for something imperfect, or worse, that have absolutely nothing to do with campaign contributions. Former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank once said, "I only voted once for someone who believes 100% of what I believe, and that's when I voted for myself the first time." The fact is that being in the institution changes the way you look at how Washington works. And you have to work hard to make sure that it doesn't change who you are. Something a constituent warned me about after I'd been in the Senate for a year or so. The woman, who was about my age, with salt and pepper hair, approached me after I spoke at a reception honoring the year's best in Twin Cities Theater. As she stared at me for a while, I could see concern growing in her eyes. "I can see out of physical reality," she informed me. "Uh-huh. You've seen corruption, and it's affected you. It's put cracks in your soul." Now, that's not the kind of thing you like to hear about your soul. But she assured me that I was a loving person with a great soul. It's just that it had been badly wounded since I'd been in Washington. She wanted me to heal my soul so it could become green and clean and good. I told her that I was going to get a massage the next day, and she thought that was a good start. Massage helped, but normally what helps my soul is getting something done for people, improving people's lives, as Paul Wellstone would say. There are plenty of potentially soul-destroying aspects of running for office and serving in the Senate. Fundraising can certainly be one of them. But you keep your eye on the prize. And it's all worth every phone call, every plane ride, every thank you note, if you can get health insurance for 20 million people. If you meet a mom whose child is alive because you help to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions can get insured. If you can get mental health care treated the same as medical care. If you can prevent an undocumented mother from being deported and separated from her American citizen children. If you can preserve net neutrality. If you can keep a family in their home. It's a privilege to be a United States Senator. Not only because you get to make this stuff happen, but because you get to work with people who are working every day themselves to make this stuff happen, Americans of goodwill, Democrats and Republicans, affluent and struggling, of every color and every faith, and non-believers, who are working to improve our country and our world. Now give me some money. Chapter 40. The Koch brothers hate your grandchildren. Give a man a fish, and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, and you feed him for a lifetime. Unless there are no fish. Maimonides and Al Franken. A note on that. Global climate change is destroying our ocean's coral reefs, home to our planet's most bountiful fisheries, and accelerating the rise of jellyfish blooms, which sound mysterious and beautiful, but are actually deadly to fish farms. In my 2008 campaign, we raised $23 million, which was widely and accurately seen as an insane amount of money. But it pales in comparison to the nearly $1 billion that Siegfried and Roy Koch, often referred to just as the Koch brothers, pledged to spend, personally and through their fundraising network, on federal, state, and local elections in the 2016 cycle. $1 billion isn't really that much to the Koch brothers. You can find that much in change going through their couch. Between them, they are worth more than $87 billion, much of it from fossil fuel. And all that money didn't just buy them an invitation to a nice fundraiser or make it so that members of Congress would take their calls. Because of the Koch brothers and their ilk, the entire Republican Party has become a party of climate denial. In the last presidential primary race, not one Republican candidate was willing to support any federal action to combat climate change. This is, of course, nuts. In December 2015, I traveled with nine of my Democratic Senate colleagues to the COP21 climate conference in Paris, where 196 countries signed on to an ambitious and unprecedented agreement to tackle climate change as a global community by setting limits on greenhouse gases. Before the conference, we met with a delegation from the British Parliament. Every member we met with, including the Conservatives, knew that climate change is an existential threat. Virtually everyone in the world believes that climate change is real and is caused by human beings, except Republicans in the United States. Especially the people who know best. 97% of climate scientists agree that climate change is real and caused by human activity. And I suspect the other 3% are being paid by the fossil fuel industry. Let's do a little thought experiment here. Let's say you went to your doctor for a checkup and he told you this. Okay, you've got to go on a diet and stop smoking. You're 50 years old. You're very overweight and your father died of a heart attack at age 51. You've really got to cut down on the carbs and start exercising. Sounds bad. But you want a second opinion, so you go to another doctor. Oh, boy, says the second doctor. I see here your father died of a heart attack at about your age. You'd be insane not to go on a diet and start working out, and for God's sakes, quit smoking. Not what you wanted to hear, so you schedule another appointment. Oh my God, says the third doctor, it's amazing you're still alive. It would be irresponsible of me not to send you right away to this well-being center at Duke for a 90-day stay. Well, that certainly seems like a drag. So you schedule another appointment, and then another, and then another. After 32 opinions, you're still not happy. But then you see the 33rd doctor. It's taken a while to schedule all these appointments, so by now you've gained so much weight that you have to go around in one of those motorized carts. It's a good thing you came to me, the 33rd doctor says. I'm sure other doctors have been telling you to do all kinds of ridiculous